I have told you everything connected with this series of lessons on the Upanishads. There is practically nothing left now. Yesterday, I touched upon certain practical aspects and personal issues involved in your living your daily life as not merely a student of yoga and spiritual life, but a person aspiring to live a good life, a comfortable and happy life, a perfect life, a satisfied life, and an integrated life. Our relationship to things, to this world, as I mentioned yesterday, is to a large extent conditioned by the structure of our own personality. We see outside what actually we are inside. I told you that degrees of reality really do not exist. Reality has no degrees. It is ever perfect. But it appears as if there is an evolutionary process taking place, and there are gradations of descent and ascent, which is what we mean by degrees, which perception is engendered by the involvement of our own selves in certain degrees of perception through the coverings of consciousness in our own selves. To repeat what I told you briefly yesterday, our involvements are external as well as personal, socio-political, physical, material, sensory, vital, psychological, intellectual, spiritual. These gradations of a perception of the nature of things reflect upon the way in which we approach things in general in the world, even God Himself. And it appears as if we can approach reality only through certain stages of graduated ascent. We cannot run out of our own skin. We are enclosed within our own selves. We cannot escape noticing the kind of involvement of our own selves in this psycho-physical individuality and this is a hard nut indeed before us, a kind of guardian knot as they call it, or traditionally known as granthis. Granthi is a knot, the way in which consciousness gets tied up to certain locations of perception and experience are known as granthis or knots. There are supposed to be three types of knots, known as Brahma granthi, Vishnu granthi, and Rudra granthi. The manner in which consciousness is tied to psycho-physical individuality is the way of the knot, actually. Either you untie the knot or you cut the guardian knot, which is supposed to be what someone did, but you cannot cut the knot. You have to untie it gradually. Nothing can be cut asunder. Everything has to be opened gradually like the blossoming of a flower. You cannot give a blow to the bud and expect it to blossom into a rose. It has to organically develop itself into a blossoming in a spontaneous, healthy, happy way manner. Actually, life has to be a happy process. It is not intended to be a torture. Life is a movement from one degree of reality to another degree of reality. One stage of perfection to another stage of perfection. One level of wholeness to another level of wholeness. You are not moving from fraction to whole. You are living a life of wholeness even now in this so-called fragmentary existence. You may be an isolated individual in human society, maybe even an unwanted person. Nevertheless, you are a whole person. Socially, you may look like a fraction of human society, a part of the large mass of humanity. That is one way of looking at things. But each individual, even up to the level of the minute cell or atom, everything is a whole in itself. You are not a half human being, even if you are totally isolated from all other things. You are not one-fourth human being at any time. You may be having nothing with you, poor man, with no relations of any kind, owning nothing, completely discarded as it were for all practical purposes. Nevertheless, you are not a part. You never feel that you are a cut-off chip of some larger whole. You are a complete person yourself under every circumstance. Inasmuch as life appears to be a movement from one level of wholeness or perfection to another level, it should not really be a source of suffering to anybody. Ānandādhyeva sarvāni bhūtāni jāyante ānandena jātāni jīvanti ānandam prayanti abhishanti dīti tad vijijñāsasvā. Says a great passage in the Taittiriya Upanishad. From bliss this world has come. The world has not come from a grief-stricken gestation. From joy of God, this world of joy has come. And it is sustained by the joy, which is the nature of perfection. It shall return to the ultimate joy, finally. From joy it has come. By joy it is sustained, and to joy it shall return. The Upanishad never says that life is a curse, that is a hell. Nothing of the kind is the message of the Upanishads. The perfection of God can create only a perfection, that is the world. Every part of your body is a perfection by itself. The littlest unknown limb of your personality is a perfection in its own way. That is why it is working in a harmonious manner. An imperfect limb cannot give you a perfect orderliness and harmony of feeling. Millions of little cells in the body, so many limbs and organs, hanging here, hanging there. Do you feel any kind of awkwardness because you have got so many parts of the body? The manyness does not affect the unitariness of your individuality. So, the way in which we have to live in this world and also to conduct ourselves as seekers of truth has to be in terms of the involvement of our consciousness in the stages of ascent and descent. Ascent is the progressive march of the soul to the Supreme Being. The descent is the evolution of the world from God up to the earth, up to the lowest atom. We are physically involved from the outermost part of our personality. Nobody can forget that there is a body. You may be essentially a pure, unadulterated consciousness, but the physical body hangs very heavily upon this consciousness, therefore it is that you have got a weight. Consciousness has no weight. The mind also cannot be measured on a weighing balance. It is the body that is heavy. It is a concentrated mass of location involving a pattern of material forces in which the consciousness, which is your real nature, is involved. It has to be counted, taken care of. Even a naughty child in a family is not to be ignored totally as if it is not existing at all. An intractable, disobedient and naughty boy in the house is not an irrelevant item in the house. It has to be taken care of and put to the pattern of the wholeness of the family structure. If some part of the body is sick, we don't cut it off. We see that it is healed and made part and parcel of the wholeness of our personality. Likewise, the involvement of our consciousness in the physicality of ours is to be taken care of by an adjustment which is in a state of harmony with the physical structure. The body is very active. The senses are active. The senses and the body work together. Actually, the body moves on account of the vibration set up by the sense organs. This activity is perpetual. Nobody can keep quiet without doing something. This is what the Gita has told you, nahi kashchit kshanam api jato tirsthat yakarma krat. You cannot sit quiet without doing something. Little bit action, a little bit of your movement is unavoidable. This is so because there is an agitation created in ourselves by the preponderance of what is called the rajas, distracting and active part of the matrix of all things known as prakriti. There are three qualities of prakriti, properties of prakriti: sattva, rajas and tamas. We are not always in a state of sattva. Clarity of perception and feeling of happiness and satisfaction inside is not always given to us. We are mostly turbid in our personality and agitated and distracted. To put down this agitating medium in ourselves, we have to employ certain means which are commensurate with this agitation. This is the work that you perform in a harmonious manner. The agitation, which is also a kind of activity, can be subdued only by another kind of activity. As a disease is cured by homeopathic medicines of a character similar to the disease already prevailing in the body. Similia, similibus curantur. Like cures like. Action can be controlled by action only. Diamond can be cut by diamond. This is a psychological secret in the approach to things generally. But what kind of action it is that can subdue agitated activity? A wholesome action. While it is true that karma or action binds, it is also true that certain karmas liberate. Na karma lipyate nare, say the Ishavasya Upanishad. Action cannot bind the human being, provided it is oriented in the light of the omnipresence of God, Ishavasya Midam Sarva. Otherwise, every action shall produce a reaction. The fruit of action, the binding power of action, He is nothing but the reaction set up by action, which is motivated by externality and conditioned by space and time and objectivity. So wholesome, God-oriented work. Work, of course, you are underlying, it is nevertheless work. God-oriented work is the means of putting down agitating work. Binding action can be subdued by liberating action. This is known as Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is the art of uniting oneself with God Himself through action. You may be wondering how action can contact God. Inasmuch as every activity is directed towards some objective that is ulterior, this is not the kind of action that we are referring to here when we talk of God-oriented activity. The Bhagavad Gita is a difficult thing to understand. It is not easy to make out the meaning of what it says when we are asked to say, when we are asked to do work in a liberating manner. A wholesome work, spiritually conditioned work, God-oriented work, unselfish work, perfected alignment of oneself in work will liberate you from the disadvantages of ordinary work. We are also very busy every day. Everybody is doing work of some kind or the other, but they are binding works. The consequence of an action will tell upon you so heavily that you may repent for having done it afterwards. As the Gita tells you somewhere, the result of an action is not entirely in your hands. Even if the farmer takes all precaution to plow the field and sow the seed and pour water and manure it, it does not follow that he will have the yielding of the harvest unless other factors also cooperate, like rain, climate, sunlight, and many other things which are of a natural nature, natural character. Inasmuch as the fruit of an action is not in your hands, it is determined by forces which are cosmic in their nature. It is unwise on the part of a person to expect a particular result from a particular action. This is what the Bhagavad Gita is telling you. Therefore, very carefully maneuvering your life in this world through a well-ordered way of activity in this world, dissociating it with the idea, dissociating it from the idea of any fruit accruing therefrom, you will find yourself in harmony with two things at the same time. With reality, you are in harmony because of the wholesome character of your work. You are also in harmony with the agitations which are caused by Rajoguna Prakriti in your personality, so that you do not oppose either the prevailing conditions at the present moment by way of Rajasic work, nor do you oppose the conditions imposed upon you by the nature of reality. You are a friend of this world and also the other world. This is the preliminary step that one can take in the practice of spiritual life, Karma Yoga. By karma alone, karma is controlled and overcome. When your mind is active, the physical body craves for work of some kind or the other. Keeping quiet without doing anything physically, but mentally brooding, is not supposed to be action which is liberating. This is what the Gita has told you. After having attained some kind of mastery over this technique of conducting yourself in the world of action, you may take to concentration, which is called upasana. You cannot take to meditation, worship, upasana as it is called, or devotion, directly when your mind is distracted or agitated. Agitations are caused by disharmony with nature, disharmony with human society, disharmony with our own psychophysical individuality. You can bring to your memory what I told you yesterday. Alignment of psychophysical individuality within harmony with society and a kind of concordance with nature as a whole is expected. Until this is achieved, direct meditational work may not be of much success. There are prejudices of varieties in the minds of people. Everybody has a prejudice. You prejudge things from your own point of view and foist your ideas upon things outside. This is the dirt that is in the mind, called mala. It is believed that the mind has three defects, known in Sanskrit as mala, vikshepa and avaran. Mala is the dirt which covers the mind like dust covering a clean mirror, whereby the mirror cannot reflect light. And even if the dust is removed, the glass may be broken and it may not be giving you a wholesome reflection. There is the craving for things, the impulses of like and dislike, love and hatred, create impressions every day in the mind, which are piled up one over the other like the clouds, which is what is meant by the dirt of the mind, which cannot be removed except by hard work. Why should you work? Why not I keep quiet? Because it is not possible for you to keep quiet. Prakriti, the nature, will not permit you to keep quiet. You have to do something. If you do not do a right thing, you will be doing a wrong thing. Instead of doing something wrong, why not do something right? When it is found that doing something is unavoidable. Scriptures give a long list of the nature of the dirt that is covering the mind. Raga, dvesha, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsara, irshya, asuya, dambha, darpa, ahankara. There are some 13 types of dirt. I am not going into the details of all this. It is not necessary for you to know. It is enough to make out the meaning of it, that there is a kind of cloud hovering around our consciousness, which is the heritage of ours, come from various births that we have passed through earlier, and has been scrubbed by karma yoga, which includes not merely the highly elevated cosmic work of the Bhagavad Gita time, which of course is the highest thing that we have to aspire for, but karma yoga also includes holy worship, rituals that you perform in altars, in temples, in places of pilgrimage, on special occasions, etc., also are part of the karma yoga. Anything that you do is a kind of work. All performance of every kind is a kind of doing. This doing of yours, which is the work, has to be a emanation of your being, and it should not be an extraneous foisting of yours. If the doing is totally unconnected with your being, it ceases to produce any result which is worthwhile. What you are doing is nothing but a projection of what you are. Then it is that your work will have a productive effect. If you speak and think what you are really inside, it will have a tremendous force. It will have a power of conviction. But if you think and speak what is not what you are, then it will be like an empty gale that is blowing for nobody's good. So, the first step in yoga, in the art of spiritual living, is karma yoga, an outline of which I mentioned to you just now. Only when you have attained palpable, tangible success in the control of your mind and bringing about a cessation of extreme agitation caused by unnecessary likes and dislikes, you will be able to sit quiet and concentrate your mind. This is upasana, a next stage. Karma scrubs the dirt of the mind which is mala. Upasana subdues the distraction of the mind which is vikshepa. Even if you are a good person, unselfish in your behavior, and for all practical purposes you are a well-behaved individual, the mind may not be under control. It will have its own distractions of a different nature. The agitations are not merely in the physical body, they are also in the mind. The mind also is constituted of the three gunas, which are sattva, rajas and tamas. So the distractions of the mind can be subdued by upasana, attempt at concentration. What kind of concentration? On what are you going to concentrate? Doubts of this kind also may arise in the mind. For all practical purposes, we may say the concentration is to be directed only on that which is your aim. An aimless life is no life. Many people live a desultory life and doing everything in a perfunctory manner with nothing positive in the approach. Life is short. We cannot go on wasting our time in experimenting with things and achieving nothing finally. Even a little good that we do in the smallest measure is a great achievement. Neha abhikramana shosti. Good deeds cannot perish. They will produce good result always. Do not try to do too many things in a day. Do small things. These small things will become big later on. The seed will become a large banyan tree later. The concentration has to be directed on what you consider as your great aim. The aim is also of a gradational character, and immediately you cannot pitch upon what kind of aim it is on which you have to concentrate. That which is immediately above your present condition may look like an aim for the present purpose. There is something just above me, and that is my aim at the present moment. If you are sick, the gaining of health is your aim. No use of thinking anything else at that time. The body is ill. What is the thing that you do at that time? Do everything. Move earth and heaven to see that health is maintained and you are robust in your personality. If you are hungry, you have starved for days together, or you have not slept for days together for some reason or the other, what do you do at that time? You take rest and do whatever is necessary to appease your hunger and thirst. These are the little things of life, but they are not in any way unimportant things. A little toothache will kill you, and a earache will know what kind of thing it is. They are not unimportant things. So, the immediate present is the object of concentration, and as I mentioned to you yesterday, nature does not gallop like a horse. It smoothly moves like the flowing river. And therefore, little things have to be taken care of first. Take care of the pennies, the pounds will take care of themselves, as they say. The little rocks make the ocean. So don't say, I'm a spiritual seeker, I'm thinking of God. While you are aching otherwise in your psyche and in your body or in your social relations. Let firm steps be taken gradually. While physical health is necessary and a reasonably secure and comfortable life in the world is, of course, very, very important. All this has to be taken care of and never to be neglected, and not allow the body to run riot or the mind to go hither and thither in its own way. Care has to be taken in these little small things. Sometimes small things upset us much more than big things. One event, one occurrence, one word is enough to upset you totally. And a tornado or a whirlwind will not upset you so much. So little things are big things. They have to be very concentratedly taken notice of. From the physical, from the social, you rise to the sensory, the psychological, and the intellectual, and the spiritual. These are the grades of the ascent of yoga practice. One of the ways of the concentration of the mind, the performance of upasana, is to adopt some means of loving what you consider as your aim. Finally, it is the love that you evince towards things that actually counts in life. Whatever be the aim or the thing that you are pursuing, it should not be mechanically pursued. It should also be loved from the heart. A thing that you do not love will not come to you. Not even a dog will not come near if you don't like it. If you dislike it, it will run away from you. The affections that you evince from your heart are, to a large extent, the thermometer which will decide the nature of the success in your concentration. The concentration of the mind on your concept of God Almighty, for instance, may be what you understand by upasana or worship from your own point of view of understanding. It may be. It is perfectly right. But there must be an ardent longing for it. The Yoga Sutra tells you, Tivra Samveganam Asanna. It is near only to that person who ardently longs for it. Anything that you intensely long for will come to you. This is the secret of life. You must ask for it. And if you ask for it wholly, from the bottom of your heart, and if you ask for it really, not unreally, from the lips only, and entirely, totally, and want only that, nothing else, it has to come under the law of things. So the success in life, whether spiritual or otherwise, is in the manner of your whole soul pouring yourself upon it, and your karma, your work also should be a pouring of yourself upon it. If you pour yourself on the work will be beautiful. All work is beauty. It is not ugly. It looks ugly and disastrous drudgery because it is an outside thing weighing heavily upon you. Anything that is outside you is not yours and it is not worth attempting at all. So the love of God must manifest itself in an appreciable measure And as you know very well, our mind is constituted in such a way that we cannot love anything in this world wholly. Some kind of affection you have got for certain things, but entirely you cannot love anything, unconditionally. Here is the whole point. Unconditionally you cannot want anything. All your wants are conditional. Under these circumstances I want it. Under these conditions fulfilled, I like you. If these conditions are not fulfilled, go. I don't want you. So do you call it love? And you put the same yardstick to measure God Himself. If these things come from Him, well, if it doesn't come, I may even think that He doesn't exist. There was a real devotee in Hong Kong, a well-wisher of the ashram and devotee of Swami Shivananda Maharaj. He had no children. Once, twice, thrice, four times, fifth times, no children. He asked people to do japa and all that. Finally, sixth time also he failed. Then he wrote a letter. I had a doubt that perhaps God does not exist. Now it is clear to me that He does not exist. This is the kind of expectation we have from God. If our bread and jam and our house and property is secure from our own point of view, God must be existing. If He is pouring rain for the need of a farmer, but by that rain He causes a building under construction to collapse nearby, what do you call God? As a kind person or an unkind individual? There is a farmer who has a dry field, who expects rain, and nearby somebody is building a house and he would not like heavy rain to fall on it. Now what should God do at that time? Should He send the rain or He should not send? One person will praise God, another will curse Him. This is to point out how difficult it is to understand things in a wholesome manner. If you cannot love a human being, you cannot love God also. Saints tell you, if you cannot love what you see, how can you love what you cannot see? An abstract wool gathering, building castles in the air, cannot be regarded as affection. Because even when you think that you are loving God, there may be suspicions inside. After all, I don't know what will happen. After all, nothing may take place. After all, I may not achieve it. After all, there may not exist, may not be existing at all. Varieties of doubts are listed in the Vedanta scriptures. Such a thing may not be there. Even if it is there, it may not be possible for me to achieve it. And even if I achieve it, what will be my fate afterwards? Many of you must be having this difficulty. After reaching God, what will happen to me? Don't say it is an unnecessary question. Very serious matter it is. After attaining God, what will you do there? You will go on sweeping the floor of God's palace, or going on looking at Him, or ordering, receiving His commands. You will find that it is a very unpleasant existence. What will you do there? Here is the question. What will I do there? You will put a question. A purification of the mind by way of unselfish karma or action will set at rest all these difficulties. Because we are now thinking in terms of a turbid mind, all these questions arise which are humorous partly and foolish partly. No such questions will arise because our concept of God is inadequate. Inadequate because our mind itself is not prepared for such a concept. So by an arduous attempt on our part to purify ourselves through worship, even by way of ritual, japa, sadhana, etc., much of this dirt can be scrubbed out and we can attempt at real concentration on the nature of reality. For your purposes, as seekers of God, the object of meditation would be, of course, your own notion of the creator of the universe. This universe must have come from some creative power. Ordinarily, you posit this creative power as a transcendent element above the world. You cannot immediately imagine that it is just now here, because it has created this which you are seeing before your eyes. And therefore it must be existing prior to that which it has created. Prior, and therefore it is also transcendent. The aboveness, the extra-cosmic nature, the transcendent character of God also is something ingrained in our mind, however much you may go on saying that is immanent. God is above us. He is a distant object. The idea of distance arises on account of spatiality and temporality involved in our experience, and also our belief that God created the world. Therefore, He must be above the world. Hence it is that we look up to the skies with open eyes when we pray to God in our own humble way. The personality of God is also something unavoidable in the earlier stages. You may be told by people that God has no form. What is the use of saying that? You cannot conceive a formless thing. Even the concept of the formless is also a form only. Even water, which has no form by itself, will assume a form when it is poured into a bucket. The bucket's nature, the shape, is the actual shape of the water. So, the manner of your thinking will decide the form of the object of your meditation. Concentration on a particular thing is what is insisted upon. And the point in concentration is that you should not think more than one thing. To the extent you are able to concentrate on one thing continuously for a large extent of time, to that extent you are successful in concentration. If two thoughts arise in the mind, it is not a successful concentration. In the earlier stages, several thoughts will arise, especially in the case of a novitiate. You will be struggling hard to fix your mind on some particular thing and struggling at the same time to avoid thoughts which are irrelevant from your point of view. When you think of God, you would not like ungod thoughts to enter into your mind. If you think of God, you would not like the thought of marketplace to enter your mind. This is how you will feel when you actually sit for meditation. That is, you will strive to shut out certain thoughts which you regard as disharmonious with the characteristics of that on which you are concentrating. So there are two thoughts. Even in your attempted concentration on one thing, two thoughts are there. The thought of the avoiding of unnecessary things and the thought of that which you consider as necessary. There is also a thought which is the third variety, the placement of this ideal in front of you. The God Almighty or whatever it is placed in the context of your perception through the mind. A kind of holy distance is maintained between you and the object. It is not just touching you. It is difficult to imagine such a thing. The thought of a little distance there is between you and the object of meditation is one thought. The thought that you would like to avoid is another thought. The thought of the nature of the object is a third thought. And the thought that you are also contemplating and you are existing is the fourth thought. So even when you are actually concentrating on one thing, attempting to concentrate on one thing at least, you will find that there are four thoughts automatically arising in your mind, though apparently it appears that you are concentrating on one thing only. The Yoga Sutras will tell you all these details. Now these four thoughts actually are not actually distracting media. They are necessary processes of overcoming the distraction of the mind. Later on, after some time, having attained success in your concentration, you will find there would be no necessity for you to avoid certain thoughts. It is only in the earliest of stages you feel that the certain thoughts are unnecessary. I should not think of the jungle, I should not think of an animal, I should not think of a railway station or a marketplace or something which is unpleasant. This is what you think. But later on you will find there is nothing unpleasant anywhere. The unpleasantness is only the wrong placement of your personality in the context of that particular occurrence. You are disharmoniously placed with that thing which you consider as unholy, evil, unnecessary, etc. If you are harmoniously placed with an event that is taking place or a thing that is there outside you, you will find that it ceases to be something unnecessary or interfering. It will never interfere with you. Your considering that it is unnecessary is the reason why it starts interfering. When you have decided that you don't want a thing, naturally you cannot expect any cooperation from that thing. But why should you consider that a thing is unwanted and it to be rejected? Because you have not understood it properly. The context of its existence in relation to the context of your existence is not properly grasped. So, in a certain advanced stage you will find that unnecessary thoughts will not be existing. Because there is nothing totally unnecessary in this world. This is a little advanced stage. In the early stages you will not be able to realize this. So, with this precaution you take to concentration and take for granted that you have achieved some success now in making yourself acquainted with the truth that there is nothing that you have to avoid in this world. So the world becomes friendly with you. Cool breeze will blow and everything will be fragrant for you. Then comes your difficulty with the object itself. How will you adjust yourself with the presence of that object in front of you, which does not seem to be touching you, which is a little distant from you? Let it be at a distance. Doesn't matter. You can glory in the beauty and the grandeur of that object for the time being. Inasmuch as you have concluded that this object is ultimately real, if it had been not for that fact, you would not be concentrating on it. It is final thing for you. All things that you expect from anything will be also there in that thing, and it will bestow upon you all that you expect. The Ishtadevata, the object of your meditation, is capable of bestowing upon you all things that anywhere anything can give you. All the world's blessing will come from that one thing. It is the concentrated point of the whole cosmos. The idea of the object, the concept of the ideal before you, the Ishtadevata so-called, is a concentrated spot of cosmic power. You can touch it and you will be touching the switchboard of the cosmos. It is not some isolated dot or a thing that you are concentrating upon. The idea of isolatedness must be taken away. It is touching one part of your body, as it were. When you touch a part of the body, even a little spot, you are touching the whole body. You know very well how it is. Because the entire body is concentrated on every part of the body. That is why you feel an entire occurrence taking place, even if only a little touch is made. Such a concept has to be introduced into the object of meditation. It is not sitting somewhere, my God is somewhere, his God is somewhere else. It is not like that. Actually, no object is in one place only. There is interconnection vitally of every object with every other object, as limbs of the body are connected integrally and internally. So you will feel happy to realize that this object of your meditation is the touchstone of the success of your meditation. It is the root of the whole cosmos. It is the vitality which you are concentrating upon, by which you can evoke the powers of the entire creation through that. Something like an incarnation. The incarnation of God may look like a particular individual, but it is a focusing point of the entire power. The whole thing is concentrated there, all the world, all creation. Then you will feel a joy inside. I am not wasting my time in concentration, because I am actually at one with that force which is gazing at me with eyes that are multifaceted, as if the whole cosmos is looking at me. Great joy it is to realize this. So concentration will become an art of feeling joy inside. Concentration and meditation are happy processes. You will never be tired. You will never be exhausted by sitting for meditation. You will feel greater and greater satisfaction. And every session of meditation will make you healthier, stronger, more wholesome in your outlook. And you will be able to convince yourself you have actually achieved something substantial. Today you have become better than yesterday. Hari Om Tat Sat.